We talk a lot on this podcast about chess improvement, but when it comes to improving your hiring processes, Indeed is the platform you need. Indeed has over 350 million global monthly visitors, and it has a matching engine that helps you find quality work candidates fast. You can use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with your candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Years ago, when I was running a chess teaching business, I found it hard to find good help, and I had to go through a lot of back and forth to even screen potential candidates. Indeed allows you to do those things efficiently in one place. Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed for hiring, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of Perpetual Chess will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility if you go to Indeed.com/chess. Just go to Indeed.com/chess right now, and you'll be supporting our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast, Indeed.com/chess. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This summer, click into cordless power with Memorial Day savings at the Home Depot. Tackle more than half an acre of grass with the convenience and gas-like power of the Ryobi 40-volt battery-powered mower. And keep your flower beds fresh with the 40-volt cordless string trimmer. Then clear debris with the 40-volt jet fan leaf blower. Click into Memorial Day savings happening now at your cordless power source, the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
Hello, everyone. I am Ben Johnson, and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. Perpetual Chess is a weekly chess interview show with accomplished chess players, authors, personalities, and adult improvers where they discuss their lives, their careers, and share tips about how to improve at chess. For more information, go to perpetualchesspod.com. So without further ado, let's get to the show. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Perpetual Chess, Chess Books Recaptured. This is theoretically a monthly bonus podcast where we talk about a notable or famous chess book. In this case, it's been a bit more than 2 months before we've done a recap, but we have an excellent excuse. We're doing two books this month, and they're two epic books. They are both about this famous candidates tournament, Zurich 1953. Those of you who are regular listeners probably are familiar with these books and definitely have likely heard them recommended here on this podcast. So we figured it was time to dig in. And joining me for this discussion is a longtime friend of the pod, impressive guy, FIDE Master, USCF 2400, Blitz rating of 2600 on chess.com. He's been the Massachusetts State Chess Champion. He's a former poker pro. He's now a data scientist. He consults for Chessable. He's writing a must-read chess newsletter called Zwischenzug. So we'll put the link for you to sign up to his Substack, which I know some of you already are, but all of you should be signed up for it. And he's coming soon to the new project, How to Chess, talking about analytics in chess. So listeners can keep an eye out for that as well. So without further ado, let's welcome our guest co-host, Nate Solon. What's happening, Nate?
Not too much. Really excited to be here. Longtime listener of the pod. So feels good to be on this side of the microphone.
Yeah, happy to have you. I feel a little guilty, I have to say, Nate. You innocently signed up for this project, and it turns out it's like we're basically doing a dissertation to discuss these two Zurich 1953 books.
Well, I really did it to myself. I was like, you know, I think I suggested Zurich, the Bronstein book initially, and I was like, yeah, why not do the Neidorf book too? And then people on Twitter chimed in to inform us that there's actually like at least two other books on this tournament too, but fortunately we kept it to two.
More than two other books, and we're not even going to try to name them all. I don't want to anger any chess historians, but one notable book that we will not be discussing is Max Ewe, the Dutch world champion. I've been practicing saying his name. He wrote in Dutch a notable Zurich 1953 book, which I don't believe has been translated to English, but even if it has, these two books is plenty. And the two books we'll be discussing, of course, is the legendary book in name by David Bronstein, of course, one of the strongest players ever to not be world champion. He had some help with that book, as we'll discuss in due time. But legendary book, you've probably heard it recommended on this podcast like numerous times. I started reviewing the notes of people who recommended it, and we had Danya Noroditsky, Robert Hess, Robert Hungoski, adult improver Andres Kwizdwa, legendary trainer R.B. Ramesh, and I'm sure there's some that I missed, and obviously just in general chess conversations, you'll hear it recommended. So for those of you who've read it, we'll help you with a few reminiscences, and those of you who haven't, we'll give you our scouting report. And then there's the slightly lesser known but also excellent book by Nydorf. Nate, what do our listeners need to know about Nydorf? I suspect some know a few things already, but.
Well, yeah, also extremely strong player. One of the strongest players in the world, obviously one of the most famous and best openings out there. The Nydorf Sicilian is named after him. Argentinian player, by all accounts, quite a character. Known for walking around during his game and talking to random spectators. So, incredible player and big personality as well.
Yeah, as we'll be discussing more, sort of legendary raconteur and player, author, successful businessman. So we'll get into all of that in due time. A little bit more about the Bronstein Zurich book, which if you hear a book recommended and someone says, oh, you have to read Zurich 1953, and they don't specify the author, they're probably referring to the Bronstein book. So Bronstein book published in English in 1956, translated by Jim Marfia. There have been countless new editions and revisions. It's now available on Kindle and still in print on paper. I'm not aware of any ebooks, anything like Forward Chess or any of the publisher's apps. I don't believe that it's available in that format, but lots of ways to read this classic book. As for the Nydorf Zurich book, it was published in Spanish in 1953 and was only translated to English in more recent years, translated by Taylor Kingston, well-known chess historian, and it seems like he did a great job on it. The book is very readable. Even now, even though the book hasn't been out that long in English, the hard copy is hard to find, but for $10, you can get the book on Kindle, which is what I did, and I believe what you did too, right, Nate?
Yeah, I've been into hard copy books whenever possible, but all the copies on Amazon of the Nydorf book were like $600 plus. So I settled for the Kindle version in this case.
Yeah, that's a bit rich for a book that's less than 10 years old. Definitely probably not necessary, and maybe they'll print another copy at some point. I think the copies that were in print, the initial printing, there were a few like typographic errors and stuff, but I think that's been fixed in the Kindle. I didn't notice any in my reading. Couple other notable things about the Nydorf Zurich book. It's got a preface by Yuri Averbakh, of course, the oldest living grandmaster, 99 years of age. And as we record this, there's been like a bit of sort of breaking news. He actually was hospitalized for COVID. And obviously at his age, that's a bit concerning, but I saw a headline yesterday. We're recording this on Wednesday, June 30th, that he's actually been released from the hospital. So it's a developing story, obviously, but glad to see that he's been released to live at home, and amazing longevity from that legendary grandmaster who participated in the tournament and wrote a great intro. And the foreword is by Andy Soltis, which we might as well spoil for you guys. We have a special surprise coming. Andy does a little cameo in this podcast. We had about a 20-minute conversation with Andy. He wrote, again, a great foreword to the book, but he also sort of waxed nostalgic and shared some of his wisdom about that. So without spoiling too much of what Andy says, and Nate was on the call as well. Nate, anything to say about our conversation with Andy?
Just it was cool to get to talk to someone whose depth of knowledge about this is so deep, because I believe he's written multiple books, not just about Zurich, but about the era, the players. So, you know, I've read the books, well, at least the Bronstein book a few times now. So I know the games, but, you know, he's really a treasure trove of knowledge about the entire era and all the players involved.
Yeah, definitely an honor to get to talk to him. And like Nate said, I mean, he wrote a book on Soviet chess history. And as he mentions at the end of the interview that you guys will hear, he has another related book coming out. So definitely something to look forward to, both in this podcast and to look forward to his book in life. So we already mentioned a bit about Bronstein. You know, a lot of you longtime chess fans will have heard of him, but couple other things to note about him. He was a very dynamic player, incredibly strong. Weinstein, who is his uncredited co-author / ghostwriter / contributor, as we'll be getting into, said about Bronstein's tactical skills. He said, "The depth of a Bronstein combination is like an iceberg hidden 9/10 underwater." And that is actually a quote from the aforementioned Andy Soltis's Soviet Chess. And just to share a bit more about Bronstein, he was number one in the world in 1950 for 19 months, according to Jeff Sonas's chess metrics, number 25 all time in the excellent Chess 24 series, the top 50 players of all time by friend of the pod, Grandmaster Jan Gustafsson, and of legendary second of Magnus Carlsen, Grandmaster Peter Hein Nielsen. He, of course, famously came within inches of beating Botvinnik in 1951 to become world champion. He drew the match, and the tie went to the champion, so he did not win the title, and he was ahead in the match. And according to Zena Sosanko, another legendary grandmaster and author, he kind of never recovered from that, as he discusses in the book, The Rise and Fall of David Bronstein. And we'll be talking more about some stuff from that book later. And yeah, there's just, should we get into the ghostwriting thing, Nate? Is it time?
We can, yeah. But just to, you know, to touch on Neidorf or Bronstein a little bit, you know, I think one of the things that really fascinates me about the book is like you said, he's a really creative player, and he's that type of creative, inventive player, like almost like a Joe Bava or a Rapport or, you know, Dubov today. But like, you know, knocking on the door of number one in the world and kind of at the forefront of this whole school of Soviet chess. So I think that's one of the things that's fascinating about that, about it, to have someone who's that creative and inventive, who's one of the best players in the world as well, and is the author of the book. As we're about to get into, is the author of maybe part of the book or with a co-writer, but you do get a lot of interesting insights in the book.
Yeah, I guess we'll save it for later. Let's give the books their respect. And then there's two sort of big controversies about the Zurich books. Number one being this recent revelation from Zena Sosanko that he said that Weinstein did the majority of the writing. We'll go over the exact wording and sort of how we parse it later. And number two, there are these allegations of match fixing by the sort of Soviet regime that now in some people's minds sort of cast a pall over the chess. But, you know, the books stand alone. Neither of the books obviously allude to these things. Again, Bronstein is the only credited author in the book, and there's maybe very vague allusions to the cheating stuff, but really not much in there at all. So I think it's probably better to talk about the books first and then get into these allegations. Now, a bit more about Weinstein, since he definitely helped with the book. he was a longtime friend of Bronstein. He wrote many books on his own. He also had some sort of KGB affiliation, although also it's not clear what the status of their relationship was at the time of the tournament. He was not there with Bronstein at the time of the tournament. A lot of the players had super strong seconds, and the field of this tournament was just like immensely strong. There were 15 participants, and out of the top 15 in the world, it included the number 2 through 15. Of course, Botvinnik, the world champion, since it was a candidates tournament, was not in it. And then Averbakh, who was like number 21 or something, was the only, like, not just running down the list of the strongest players in the world, not the only player who was not in it. And as we'll be talking about with both with Grandmaster Andy Soltis and here with Nate, I think the reason the book is famous is the games. I mean, the games, there's just so many bangers, so many just amazing games. If you've like seen some famous games from chess history and you don't know where they came from, like there's a very good chance it was from Zurich 1953 and you might not have even realized it. There's like the Petrosian Rookie Six famous exchange sacrifice, this crazy defense from Max Uwe, and just so much more. I mean, Nate, again, we're going to get into Andy's segment in a minute, but do you agree that that's what differentiates these books, if anything?
Yeah, I think that the combination of the so many strong players gathered in one tournament, which was not an everyday occurrence in those days, you know, you couldn't just get everyone on their computer and have an online tournament with a bunch of strong players. You had to get everyone together, and it was hard to choose a venue. It was hard to get all the players to come. And then, like you said, the super strong games, and also I think really rich in ideas. Like, it seemed to be an era where the state of the art of chess was advancing rapidly. There was a lot of experimentation. There was a lot of, you know, especially in the Soviet school, very strong players working hard together and testing different ideas, you know, studying and training together, but then competing against each other at the same time. So it seemed like a moment where people were pushing the frontiers of chess, and it was just sort of an exciting moment in chess history.
Yeah, for sure. That definitely comes across in the games with lots of new opening ideas and yeah, just sparkling play in between all the draws. So just to give you guys a little more historical context again, I think some of you will know this stuff, but 30 rounds, so 210 games, which is why this has been such an epic project for Nate and I. The participants were Samuel Reshevsky, Paul Keres, David Bronstein, Tigran Petrosian, Efim Geller, Alexander Kratov, Mark Taimanov, Yuri Averbakh, Isaac Boleslavsky, Laszlo Szabo, Svetislav Gligorich, Max Uwe, Gideon Stahlberg, and of course, Miguel Najdorf. Amazing games throughout. And there were tons of strong seconds in attendance. This is a quote from the Najdorf book. All the grandmasters participating except Reshevsky and Bronstein had their seconds, whose principal job consisted of analysis of adjourned games. Of course, those of you newer to chess saw the adjourned games, hopefully in Queen's Gambit, where, you know, this is in the pre-computer age. So having a strong player there with you to help you study when the position gets postponed is obviously super helpful. Acting as Gligorich's second was Dr. Trifunovich for Taimanov, Flor, Julio Bobachan for Najdorf, who also Bobachan may have helped with helped Najdorf with the book as well. Lilienthal for Petrosian, Bielen for Averbakh, Vanderberg for Uwe, Skold for Stahlberg, Florian for Szabo, Sokolsky for Boleslavsky, Moiseev for Kotov, Bondarevsky for Geller, Samajin for Smyslov, and Toulouse for Keres. So that's just a small side note. I mean, some of those names might be familiar to you all, and some won't, but there weren't that many grandmasters in the world at that time. And in addition to the participants, to have like another like 7 or 8 on hand is just crazy. And Reshevsky and Bronstein both had decent showings. And Reshevsky to be battling for the lead without a second is definitely a testament to his skill. So anything else, Nate, before we get to Andy's interview? Andy, of course, we talk about a lot of topics, and some of it will tease topics that Nate and I are going to flesh out later. But the principal question that we discuss with Andy is, what makes this tournament special? Anything to add before we hop into that, Nate?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's really interesting that, Reshevsky and Bronstein didn't have seconds, because they did both somewhat collapse towards the end of the tournament. So I guess you wonder a little bit if the fatigue, because this was, apart from being a super strong tournament, it was a grueling tournament because the field was large and it was a double round robin. So it's just, the players had to play an enormous amount of chess. So stamina was a huge factor in this tournament as well. And that was, you know, and I think in both of the books that Smyslov, of course, was the ultimately the winner of the tournament and the challenger for the world champion. And they attribute that partly just to his, he was in good physical shape and he was able to continue at a relatively high level to the end of the tournament.
Yeah, although funny enough, it's hard not to get into the sort of the treachery in Zurich that that we'll be discussing, because they, one of the alleged reasons for the match fixing that we're going to discuss is that Smyslov maybe was running out of energy. But anyway, we'll get to that in due time. But Nate raises an important point. I mean, just imagine like 8 weeks, two locations. And by the way, sometime you'll hear this tournament referred to as Zurich Neuhausen, because it actually started in this Swiss resort town called Neuhausen. And only later moved to Zurich because the tournament was just so long. And obviously, like something like the World Championship these days is over in less than a month. So to have the candidates take 2 months is just boggles the mind. Anyway, without further ado, we're gonna drop in the interview that we already played with legendary Grandmaster Andy Soltis. Obviously, he has a lot of great insights. So we're gonna take a quick break to hear from our sponsors. Then you'll hear the interview with Andy. Then you'll hear some more ads from our sponsors, and then boom, we will be back. So without further ado, here is Nate and I's conversation with Grandmaster Andy Soltis. Perpetual Chess is proud to be brought to you in part by Chessable.com. Chessable, of course, is known for its proprietary move trainer technology, which utilizes space repetition to quiz you and make sure that you remember whatever tactical patterns or opening sequences that you're working on. They have a huge catalog of great books from top flight authors, both for purchase. And if you check for their short and sweet courses, you can find tons of free content. Speaking of free content, Chessable, of course, has also recently launched an adult improvement focused chess podcast called How to Chess, with yours truly hosting it. Check for it on Chessable's YouTube channel, and you can also subscribe on the podcast platforms.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
So Nate Solon and I are here, and we are joined by the legendary author, grandmaster, and multiple time past and future guest of Perpetual Chess. Of course, this gentleman wrote the foreword to the English version of the Nydorf Zurich 1953 book. So definitely an honor to have him reflect on these books a little bit. Let's welcome Grandmaster Andy Soltis. Thank you for popping in, Andy.
Glad to be here.
So Nate, where should we begin? What do you think?
Well, I think we wanted to dig into the history, right? So the historical context around the Zurich tournament, and then we'd also, I've just been reading Andy's articles on possible sort of intrigue and collusion at the tournament as well.
Yeah, we should definitely get to that, although we could talk about that for hours. But Andy, why don't we begin sort of, as Nate says, alluding to the history, could you give us a little context of why you think this tournament and these two books are so famous?
Well, one thing that you can point out is that the games are just of such a high quality. There was a tournament just a couple of weeks ago in this Grand Chess Tour, and the games were played in Bucharest. It was a classical tournament. There's not a single game in that tournament that would be rated among the top 30 in the Zurich tournament. The Zurich tournament just had, you know, phenomenal games. You know, look at anybody's game collection, Erva's best games, Neidorf's best games, Taimanov's best game. They all, you know, two or three games from those books we will find in coming from Zurich, 1953. The second thing is, these two authors were doing basically a labor of love. I don't think Neidorf wrote anything that was nearly as good as this, and it's, I think it's also true of Bronstein. Bronstein came home from the tournament and to Moscow. He got together with his old buddy Boris Weinstein, who was actually a former colonel in the secret police. He was really a dreaded character. And the first thing that Weinstein asked him was, well, you know, why don't you write a book about this? And he did. And it became the biggest selling tournament book in history. I mean, it sold 300,000 copies in the various Russian editions. You know, tournament books typically sell about 1,000 copies, you know, something like that. So, and then you have Neidorf. And I don't know what his working conditions were like, but I think he got, you know, carte blanche from his publisher. He had the support of the government. What isn't really well known is that when this came out in Spanish, the Neidorf version, it was two volumes. And the introduction, it was the dedication page. He dedicated the book to El Presidente, Juan Perón, best known today as, you know, that guy who married Evita. Okay. So he got some support in doing this. But so you have the combination of two very entertaining writers doing their best and just a marvelous collection of games. And it was a big deal because in those days, there was usually one big tournament a year. I mean, nowadays we have hundreds. One thing you can, you know, put into the historical context, they didn't have international tournaments the way we do now, where anybody can organize something big by inviting the 10 best players in the world. People just didn't do that during the Cold War. In fact, tournaments were always held, if on a really high level, in neutral locations like Zurich or Helsinki or Amsterdam. That's where all of the big tournaments during the, you know, the early 50s were held, because they simply couldn't get agreement. You couldn't have a tournament in New York and get the top players from the Eastern Bloc. They certainly weren't going to have that in Moscow during the days of Stalin. So it was an extraordinary situation there.
Yeah, that was what struck me, because especially with the Bronstein book, and you mentioned this in the foreword, that the Neidorf book may be better, and Nate and I are going to talk more about the comparing the books later in the podcast. But it struck me that it can't really be the prose that makes this book so famous. So I agree with you that it's the games, and the games really do sparkle. There's so many. Although being that this is audio only, Nate and I have resolved not to spout variations or talk about specific moves.
We're not going to be variations monitors, as I think that's what Bronstein said.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, to Andy's point about the quality of the games, I think, you know, I don't know how they would stack up in terms of like accuracy according to the engine, but they're really rich in ideas. Coming back to this this book after not having read it for a while, mm-hmm. my memory was that it was sort of this classical era where things had, you know, ideas had crystallized, and coming back to it, that was partly true, but not really. Like, you know, they certainly ideas had advanced to a certain level, but it also struck me watching the games that a lot of experimentation and invention was happening too. You know, people were trying things and innovating a lot in this tournament as well.
Yeah, you know, to that point, a good example would be Taimanov's system in the K King's Indian Defense is white, which I think they call it the classical variation nowadays. The system, just playing knight f3 and bishop to e2 and playing d5 at the key point, that was almost new at those days. Kaimanov had introduced a system of doing that only a year or so earlier in a Soviet championship and won a lot of games. But then, you know, sometime later, in this like a year, information traveled so slowly that Svetozar Gligorich came up with a response. He was going to play in a tournament in Mar del Plata just before a round. He had an hour to kill. He came up with something of a defense for black. It's now called the Mar del Plata variation.
Yeah.
He didn't, you know, like, he didn't have a computer. But that information didn't travel well. So when Neidorf uses the Mar del Plata variation in this tournament, in like one of the early rounds, it shocks his opponent. And Neidorf wins a wonderful game. They were coming up with these ideas in the King's Indian, of course, and the Nimzo Indian. There are very few E4 games in this tournament. But some of the ideas have stood up pretty well. Strangely enough, you're not going to find very many opening variations that are known as the Zurich variation or the Zurich defense, although they date from this great meeting of the minds.
Yeah, it was interesting to see. You can kind of see the theory of the Mar del Plata variation developing in real time, which is, I was surprised that it was so new and trendy in this tournament, because these days that's probably like the most iconic variation of the King's Indian defense. I don't know if it's the most common, but it's that type of play with white pushing the pawns on the queen side and black going for the pawn storm on the king side. That's what you think of when you think of the King's Indian defense. But in that tournament, it was fairly new, and it seemed like the evaluation of those types of positions was people, you know, there's a lot of disagreement on is it playable for black? Is it actually better for black? They were still mm-hmm. figuring out those positions.
Sure, but except the difference is that nowadays the games start around move 25 in that variation. At Zurich, they started around move 12. That's when the players were thinking on their own.
Yeah, and the King's Indian generally, I'm sure Nate and I will be expounding on this more at another point, but there's just so many King's Indians in the book. And one of the points I realized, I think for players below 1800, I actually don't think this book is going to be like that instructive between the sort of sparse annotations and the level of play and the outdatedness of the openings, I think is a bad combination. It doesn't take away the historical context and the fact that just reading the books to appreciate is, can be greatly enjoyable. But I think for strictly instructive value, it's maybe not great for players that level. But I do think there might be a notable exception with the King's Indian because there are so many games. But Andy, we've only got you for a bit of time, and we've got a lot of topics to talk about. Now, another thing that Nate and I will probably talk about more when you're offline and try not to slander you is the articles you wrote for Chess Cafe, the Treachery in Zurich, Parts 1 and Parts 2. And that's another interesting thing about this tournament, of course, is all the sort of intrigue about, you know, these days you have Jenna Sosanko saying that Weinstein maybe wrote the majority of Bronstein's book. And then you have the separate thread about the match fixing as you've written. So, I mean, there's so much that could be said about it, Andy, but like when you think about the books and the tournament, how soon does your mind go to those allegations by Bronstein?
Good question. I don't know. It's really hard because, when Bronstein's charges came out, which he waited until, I think, 2011, or 2001, rather, Viktor Korchnoi's reaction was, if you really hated this tournament, why did you write such a beautiful book? And Smyslov's reaction was, Davy, he called him Davy all the time, Davy, why are you spoiling such a good tournament? I don't think it spoils it. I think it adds a level of interest that doesn't exist with other tournaments. Smyslov's response, by the way, it really wasn't very much. He didn't say, he didn't defend himself, basically. He just said, well, you know, a lot of bad things happened and by other people, and Bronstein shouldn't be so proud of the way that he won the previous candidates tournament, where there was probably even more cheating. And he didn't really come up with any, but you know.
But to be, sorry, just to hop in for a second, Andy, but to be clear, there were no allegations of impropriety by Smyslov, right? It was more just like the puppet masters.
Well, yeah, but the implication is he knew what was going on. He had a sense that there's this one point when they're all of the puppet masters are meeting with Bronstein and Smyslov, and Bronstein supposedly is having doubts about cooperating and drawing with Smyslov, and Smyslov says, "Well, yeah, but you know, Karas played to win. He refused, and Karas had been in a similar situation where they, you know, told Karas that he had to draw with the white pieces against Smyslov, and Karas refused, and he tried to win, and he lost, and the game is remembered as one of Smyslov's greatest victories." So I think he sort of like had a nodding idea of what was going on. Maybe not, you know, the other players in the tournament sort of gave the same indication. They knew something might be going on. I asked Yuri Auerbach when the Bronstein article came out. Yuri was playing, was actually attending a Chess Collectors International convention in Philadelphia. He was giving a lecture, and I asked him afterwards, what do you think about Bronstein's article? And he said, you know, Bronstein has a credibility problem, and, you know, there may have been some overeager, overzealous KGB involvement there. But I didn't know anything about this going on. And Mark Simonov wrote in his memoirs, there was this general sense that under no circumstances could Reshevsky be allowed to win the tournament. And Simonov wrote this in a book that hasn't been translated yet. It's his memoir is called, in Russian, it's like Remembering the Most. But one thing that he said that struck me in the book, Simonov said that and there's one key game where when Bronstein has played Geller, and Geller has sort of like double crossed him by, instead of throwing the game to him, he's beaten him. And Taimanov said that he saw Bronstein that night, and Bronstein was in terrible condition. He was crying. He was drunk. He was the most distraught that Taimanov had ever seen him. And that sort of confirmed in my mind that, you know, this is a legitimate, you know, story by Bronstein. Bronstein's just not making stuff up. Maybe he's embellishing, as Yuri Auerbach said. Maybe, you know, he's giving a lot more detail. You know, he came up with quotes that had happened 50 years before. And, you know, I always have doubts about when, you know, people reconstruct events that were that distant in the past. But on the whole, I would have to trust Bronstein's account over Smyslov's, simply because Smyslov had nothing to say. And nobody else can dispute it at this point.
That was my impression after reading, you know, reading your articles and a little bit of the other sources, was it's really hard to know the extent or the effectiveness of the machinations, but it certainly seemed like there was something going on.
Yeah, there's another footnote there. Taimanov said, you know, we were used to this type of stuff. He didn't say specifically what stuff, but he said, you know, everybody who played in the candidates tournament, all the Soviet players, had already played in the interzonal a year before in Stockholm. And there we were all told, you know, unofficially, but we were all told, you cannot try to beat Alexander Kutov. And Kutov had no business being in that interzonal. He had cheated to get into it. You know, he got his friends, his fellow comrades in the Communist Party, to push somebody else out of the way, a guy named Lev Aronin. so that Katov could play in it. And so the other Soviet players all drew with Katov very quickly. Katov won the tournament. In fact, he won it walking away. It was the greatest achievement of his career. And it like annoyed Bobby Fischer 10 years later because there was another interzonal also in Stockholm, and he met Katov, and Fischer was easily winning the tournament, and he told Katov, I have to win this tournament by the bigger margin than you want it. What did you want it with, like 2.5 points? And Katov said, well, something like that. And Fischer said, okay, it has to be 3. I think Fischer fell short. So there was an understanding, you know, that there's some strange business going on. And I think this really began around that period because I don't think, well, the Soviets didn't play that often abroad before 1952-53. The political involvement, I think, began around that time.
Yeah, fascinating stuff. And Andy, of course, is the author of Soviet Chess, 1971 to 1991, a great historical compendium. So knows of what he speaks. So, Andy, and again, we could talk about this intrigue for first hours. But to me, the bottom line is, as you guys have alluded to, there's a lot of smoke, but at the same time, we'll never know. So there's only so much that can be said. Now, Andy, how do you compare this era of Soviet chess to chess in Russia today and the sort of modern chess scene?
Well, I think the quality of play, of course, is higher because of, the intensity of the young kids, the help of the computers. Right now, you know, the Russian establishment, so to speak, is coming around in support of their best players. You can see this in the preparations for the next World Championship match. Jan Nepomniachtchi, that's how you pronounce it, Jan Nepomniachtchi. Everybody calls him Nepo because they can't pronounce it otherwise.
Okay. I'm taking notes here.
He's getting, you know, he's
no,
getting
that,
all
that's
sorts
scary because now when I screw it up later, you know, I'll really have no excuse.
Right.
They're making it harder. I just call him Nepo. And the funny thing about his is it's like his name is sort of like a Russian word meaning forgetful, believe it or not. But anyway, he's got all sorts of corporate support and more or less the support of friends in the government. So this is sort of like an interesting development. I mean, I don't think there was that kind of support for Sergei Kayakin when he played Magnus 4 years ago in New York. I think this is a different level. And it's going to lead to a very interesting match. You know, he's not going to be short on any theoretical support. You know, his colleagues in the grandmaster ranks are going to be devoting a lot of input, like in the days when everyone had to give their best ideas to Karpov. This is not going to be, you know, one person Magnus versus one person Jan. It's going to be Team Nepomniachtchi versus Team Carlsen, and guess who has a bigger team?
Yeah. I mean, Carlsen is not lacking for resources these days, but yeah, it's tough to compete with the Russian government if they're and as you say, corporate support as well.
Mm-hmm. And before we leave, I want to make one plug.
Of course.
I have a book, by the way, coming out. It's called Smyslov, Bronstein, Geller, Taimanov, and Averbakh, a chess multi-biography with 220 games. And there, of course, all five of these guys played in Zurich. So if you really want to, you know, get some footnotes to the tournament, you can. This book will be out. It's a McFarland book. It'll be out in a month or two. I think I have an advanced copy right now, but it's beginning to look very good.
Excellent. And Andy, of course, I would be happy to have you on to discuss that book properly in a few months' time. Give me some time to read it. I have to recover from this project, but that would be an honor. So thank you so much for popping in, Andy.
Okay, anytime.
Okay, great to, I don't know, meet you, whatever you want to say, but great to talk with you and get some of your insight.
Me too.
Okay. Thanks so much, Andy. And Nate, to be continued.
Absolutely.
Very good. Take it easy then.
Perpetual Chess is brought to you in part by aimchess.com. If you haven't checked out aimchess.com by now, what are you waiting for? What aimchess does is it collects your games from the major chess sites and then gives you actionable advice of how to improve your game. It might be to work on a specific opening or to get better at end games or improve your time management or whatever it may be. And then it gives you related puzzles to help you improve that specific skill. They are constantly improving the site. They recently added blindfold tactics, time management training, common checkmate patterns. So there's so much to do there. If you decide to subscribe, be sure to use the promo code PERPETUAL30. Details are in the show notes for aimchess.com.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply.
And we are back, and obviously an honor and a pleasure to talk to Grandmaster Soltis. Nate, any reflections on that conversation?
Yeah, just really interesting to get the perspective of someone who's gone so deeply into it. I guess my takeaway after reading the various sources and talking with GM Soltis was, there was definitely some funny business going on, but it's really hard to say how extensive or effective it was. And you know, it seemed like for a lot of the grandmasters, sort of, they would rather stick to the chess. And there were these guys around who were trying to influence the tournament, but maybe it was somewhat of a distraction. Maybe it was more than that. It's hard to say at this point.
Yeah, and I think we should dig into that deeper. I still feel like we should give the books as they, because again, this stuff is not in the books, you know, which is funny because now I feel like when you talk about the book, it's like, it's what you want to talk about, what I want to talk about. But I feel like we should give the books their airing and then we'll come back to what Andy said. But I did enjoy hearing his story about meeting Grandmaster Yuri Averbakh, because I'd read an old interview on Chess Cafe by the aforementioned Taylor Kingston, translator of the Nydorf Zurich book. And Averbakh was pretty dismissive of Bronstein's allegations. But Andy is, I don't know if dismissive is the right word, but he still gives them a lot of weight. But again, we'll come back to this later and give it a full airing. Because I also just think Andy's observation about, like, it's the chess, like the reason these books are so famous is the chess. And there's different strengths and different weaknesses of both the Bronstein and the Nydorf book. But the bottom line is the games are so amazing that if you go through them, you'll benefit from each. Although, as we'll also get to, I'm not going to be giving like a full-throated, unequivocal recommendation of these books for like all chess fans. There'll be some caveats for sure. But Nate, maybe a good place to go next is like, for which chess fans are these books most beneficial?
Yeah. No, good question. I think I would say you know, the books are somewhat different. Like the Nydorf book is longer, the comments are more extensive. Bronstein sort of just pops in at interesting moments, but neither book holds your hand that much. So I would say, you know, probably 1600 plus. It's hard to say an exact rating, but definitely not, you know, really new beginners to chess, because I think these books, you sort of have to some extent, bring your own, some of your own curiosity, some of your own knowledge to get the most out of them. So I would say, you know, around 1600, but all the way up as far as you want to go, if you haven't read these books, because I think that to me, the real reason to read these is like the idea of chess culture, which people talk about, which I take to mean sort of a knowledge of chess history, classic games, as well as typical structures and plans. And this is just a collection of games that's so iconic and I think forms the basis of a lot of strong players' understanding of chess. So just absorbing and internalizing the patterns and plans and maneuvers in these games is really helpful for developing that chess culture.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I definitely agree 1600 plus, maybe even 1800 plus, depending on your tolerance for ambiguity, because there's definitely going to be some ambiguity if you go through the annotations of this game. Friend of the pod, Christoph Zalecki, aka Chess Explained, he has a nice YouTube video where he kind of just goes through a few of the games and he points out some flaws in the analysis. I think of the Bronstein book, but then, and that's without an engine. He just noticed some things without an engine. And I agree that the thing about Bronstein's observations in the book is they're extremely incisive. They're so to the point about the game that, like, when he pops into a game and gives you a nugget, it's incredibly instructive, but they're sparse. So it's just not that much. And there's so many games. So you're just going through move after move and you're occasionally getting an explanation. And when you get an explanation, it's amazing, but they're not that frequent. And sometimes he doesn't highlight key moments and stuff like that. So I read the review of, I've read this many times, Chess Life magazine book reviewer, I am John Watson, of course, a friend of the podcast. He did a great interview way back in the annals if anyone wants to go back and find it. But obviously, I am Watson's knowledge of chess history is unquestionable, the author of Secrets of Modern Chess Strategy. So he wrote a review comparing the two books. And in John Watson's review, he pointed out that it might be that a lot of people sort of name these books as their favorites just because there weren't that many books when they were kids, you know, and then that their coach recommends the book. And from there, it just sort of gets passed on. Now, a couple notes of comparison about the Nydorf book is it does provide better context. So the Bronstein book, I can totally see someone hearing it recommended on this podcast, getting super excited, you know, opening the book for the first time. And it's basically they just drop you right into the first round. And there's very little context given about sort of the standings in the round. As we've said, the annotations are sparse, amazing, but sparse. The games are amazing, but there's not that much explanation. The Nydorf book, as Nate said, the explanations are maybe there's moderately more annotation. Maybe they're not as sharp. But what they do in the Nydorf book is they give you bios of the players. They give you a little bit more context. You know, Nydorf shares a few memories. It has the nice preface by Averbach and the foreword by Nydorf. So if you're more of a chess culture enthusiast and you're not reading it like with the sole goal of getting better at chess, then I think there's something to be said for the Nydorf book. But if your goal is chess improvement, then A, I'm not sure these are the best books, honestly, in this day and age. And B, maybe go with the Bronstein books. I mean, that's a bit of a hot take I just gave there. Although I will say in the aforementioned Chess 24, top 50 players of all time, Peter Hein Nielsen basically said he's not a huge fan of Zurich 1953 for all of its fame. So I feel like we might as well get into it now. Nate, what's your like overall impression if a, you know, 16 to 1800 player asks you for a book recommendation? Are you going to recommend one of these books?
Yeah, I think I would, you know, just because the Bronstein book was such a touchstone for me, like that's kind of why I picked it for this, is that it was one of the most memorable books for me learning chess as a kid. I think because it helped instill some kind of curiosity or love for the game. I will admit that, you know, I think a lot of people now, you know, adult improvers who don't have a lot of time are very focused, understandably, on efficiency. And I will admit this is maybe not the most efficient book to improve your chess because it's a lot of games. So I think this is maybe not the book to put in the spreadsheet. This is like the book to sit down with a glass of scotch, you know, and enjoy the game. But I do think the sort of the love for chess and the curiosity that comes through
in Bronstein's annotations, as well as the games. It's sort of like a great way to build up your appreciation of chess culture and history. So if you know, one book to improve your rating the most in 3 months, probably not the optimal book, but a great book to sort of fuel your love of chess and understanding of chess, I do think that they're really good.
Yeah. And it seems a bit sad to me to even have to say that, you know. I mean, obviously I would like to get better at chess. We all work to improve at chess, but like this, as you say, it's a historical touchstone in the canon, the Bronstein book, especially just because the Bronstein book, whether deserved or not, seems to have sort of a higher place on the pedestal in terms of reputation. But yeah, I mean, it's just, the games are so incredible, and that's the main thing that makes the book the touchstone that it is. And again, we're talking about, it was written in an era when, you know, a lot of the games that people could get their hands on would be like unannotated in an Informator, maybe not even that when it first was published. Maybe you wait for a chess magazine. So the things that we're describing as faults now, like, you know, pretty sparse annotations by Bronstein, wouldn't necessarily be considered faults back then. We're kind of spoiled for choice. And the other thing to emphasize with the Bronstein book in particular is just the annotations are sparse, and of course there's going to be mistakes, but they're so incisive at times. I mean, it's kind of like, mm-hmm. the impression I get with the book is like if two, you know, club level players are arguing about a position and you're arguing for hours looking at it or something, and then Bronstein just like walks in and like tells you the truth about a certain position. It's sort of like that feeling over and over again, but then he leaves, you know. So it's not like he stays and goes over the whole game with you. He just goes and goes over the like finer points of planning. And it's amazing in that regard. The Neidorff book has more annotations, but again, maybe not quite as precise. How do you compare the annotations, Nate?
Yeah, well, I think for me, I definitely am in the Bronstein camp of, I think like your description is perfect of like, it's like, you know, he just sort of comes in and gives the final word on it. But I would say not only for a specific game, but maybe for a structure or an opening. And I feel like there's some moments in there where it's like, you know, for a structure or opening or even some sort of dynamic that can occur in any chess game, it's like, I can just read one paragraph and it's like, I have some insight that's going to serve me, you know, for my whole chess career.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of that. And again, there's so many landmark games, but we're resolved not to just sort of spout be variations mongers, as you said to Soltis. Like, we're not just going to spout moves. We're not even going to talk about the games in that much detail. But I did flag just one quote to sort of give listeners an idea of the sort of tone of Bronstein's writing. And then we'll also share kind of the opening paragraphs. But here's one. And again, I guess we should say Bronstein or Weinstein's writing. He says, the placement of White's pieces radiates a great deal of potential energy, which ought to be converted into kinetic. White must set his center pawns in motion, activating both his rooks and his deeply buried dark squared bishop. The most logical plan would seem to be the advance of the e-pawn first to e4, then to e5, to drive Black's knight from f6 and lay the groundwork for a kingside attack. Black, in turn, must prevent the e-pawn's advance or counterattack the white pawn center, which will lose some of its solidity the moment the pawn advances from e3 to e4. In this game, Reshevsky combines both of Black's ideas to achieve a favorable disposition of his forces, while Neidorff does not put nearly enough vigor into the execution of his plan. So that's Reshevsky, Neidorff, obviously. Yeah, and it's just like so concise about sort of the high-level planning that's going on in the game. But again, I mean, if you pick up this book and you're like, oh, the famous Zurich 1953, I can't wait to read this and get the full story. You don't get the full story. You're just thrust into the games. No player bios, you know, no round by round horse race of who's winning the tournament. And the Neidorff's book does have that stuff. So, yeah, as long as you know what you're getting, there's, like you say, if you're just going to fend for yourself and try to figure out a book, you know, the comments are high level and the games are amazing.
Yeah, I think there's this quote from one of Bronstein's introductions that gets at that. Where he said, I felt that, so here's the quote. I felt that the author's ideas and conclusions should form the basis of this book, with the moves played in each game serving to annotate them, as it were. So it's sort of, in that sense, it's not really about the tournament. It's, the tournament is just sort of the canvas for Bronstein to express his ideas about chess, which, you know, I feel like his ideas are incisive enough that I really enjoy that. But if you're here for the tournament itself, you know, the drama, the competition, the sort of trappings and circumstances of the tournament, like you said, you get very little of that. It's really, yeah, it's about the chess ideas almost exclusively.
Yeah, he has a quote actually to that point, and this kind of rounds out what he writes in the very introductory paragraphs, which is, he says, books about chess tournaments belong to a special class of literature which would seem at first blush to be rather restrictive of the author's creative possibilities, since he must write not on themes of his own choosing but about chess material already created. But this is not quite true. The author is free to treat the games any way he wishes, to make generalizations and to uncover the ideas and plans actually executed, as well as those that could have occurred in the actual or some other games. So yeah, exactly. And one other thing, I think Andy Soltis might have alluded to this, but anyone like trying to decide if they're going to buy the book should know that it's very sort of imbalanced in the opening that it covers. It's like 20% of the games are E4 or something. So yeah, if you're thinking
E4 was very much in fashion.
Yeah.
At that crazy moment, most of the games started with D4.
Yeah, and then a few like other closed setups, but the E4 games are quite rare, which is unusual. Like, I feel like that was a rare moment, sort of. I mean, generally in chess history, you're if anything, slightly more likely to see E4. Mm-hmm. But yeah, in this book, lots of King's Indians and some Nimzos and, you know, some Queen's Gambit declines and so on, but not that much E4, which again, if you're choosing the book, I mean, some people, I know people are drawn towards like their openings, even if you're willing to sort through some others, yeah, as well. But if you're an E4 player, it's something to be aware of.
It is honestly a pretty big consideration, because a big part of the case I'm making for the book is developing the understanding of these typical plans and structures. But clearly that's going to be a lot more valuable if it's the structures and openings that you actually play yourself. One thing I did want to mention while we're on this topic, sort of going back to what you were saying about a lot of the games having sparse annotations, and also what GM Soltis said about, you know, this was a time where you couldn't just open up Chess Base, like access to the games themselves was a big part of it. I do think this is a case where you probably get like 80% of the value of this book from 20% of the games.
Yeah.
And in that era, you know, they had to include the game store from all the games, because that was a big part of the value of the tournament book, was just access to the game stores. But these days, where you can easily get access to the game stores, I think, you know, there's something you said for sort of like a greatest hits, like the best games with the richest annotations. Maybe we can actually put together a list of like 10 or 20 games. And just say like, you know, these are like the highlights. I think you can get a lot of the value, maybe not going through every single game.
Yeah, I actually had the same thought, and I agree, we could put together a list like that. And since you said it, and since I'm never actually going to do it, I'll even expound. Someone could call the book like Zurich Remixed, and just have like 20, 30 games annotated basically move by move. And, you know, with a little bit of context or some sort of, you know, some sort of way to tie them together, whether it be by opening or like tied through the drama of the tournament. But I do think that there's a way to make the book sort of more entry level and really help newer chess fans appreciate the staggering beauty of some of these games. Just a bit more before we move on to a few of the other topics, but I also wanted to read a little bit from Nydorf, just to give listeners a little flavor of what his writing style is like. So here's the opening paragraph of the Nydorf book. which is, he says, I have long wished to write a chess book, and as good intentions are sometimes actually realized, the happy circumstance has just been presented by the great World Championship Candidates Tournament. There exists a general opinion that chess is a very difficult game, but if one looks closely, that difficulty is neither less nor greater than that of many other sports. The difficulty, contrary to general belief, lies not in playing chess, but in learning to play well. And on he goes, and again, a lot more annotations. But as you mentioned earlier, Nate, you don't get his personality as much as one might hope in this book.
Yeah, it's in his personal life, he had the reputation of being a really colorful character. His writing's pretty sort of traditional and didactic, by contrast.
Yeah, but again, definitely a better job explaining it, but still. Some inconsistencies, especially if you just hold the book side by side. Each game more or less tells a different story. I don't know if we should delve into the individual games at all. I think that, as you said, Nate, that might be a better thing for us to just sort of drop a playlist in the show notes sort of thing. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that I could sort of put together a list of, you know, what I think are some of the highlight games. So I feel like that would be, has Martin Eustason been on this show?
Yes, he has.
I feel like this would be like a great project for him, like the Zurich remix. Like,
yeah,
he would knock that out in like a weekend somehow.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Martin Eustason, being also known as Say Chess on Twitter. Shout out to Martin. And yeah, he's working on, I don't think it's secret, he said it on Twitter, Chess Fundamentals remix of Capablanca's classic book. And he, of course, was an adult improver on the show who wrote the blindfold chess puzzle book. But yeah, definitely something that someone should get on. So is it treachery in Zurich time, Nate? What do you think?
We've teased it.
Actually, we're going to tease it once more, because I want to talk about the ghostwriting topic that we also teased and alluded to, because I feel like that one's easier. There's less to debate. There's less to be said. And so again, as we mentioned in Jenna Sosanko's book, Smyslov on the Couch, he alluded to, or no, sorry, it was in, I believe it was in the, of course, The Rise and Fall of David Bronstein. Jenna Sosanko wrote that Bronstein told him that Weinstein, and this is in quotes, wrote the entire narrative part. And that Bronstein in turn just did the analysis. But it's a bit confusing to me, because some of the narrative part is very sort of first person and personal. Mm-hmm. So there's sentences like in the book, Bronstein, air quotes, because now we don't know if it's really Bronstein saying, "Nevertheless, I feel bound to admit to the reader that I sacrificed more from intuition than calculation." That was in the game against Max Uwe. Or during the game and afterward, I was unable to shake the feeling that I had a win somewhere. He describes the playing hall at times. And of course, Weinstein, and famously as a sort of subplot, was not in Switzerland at the time. In fact, late in the tournament, it said that Bronstein was a bit preoccupied because he was worried that he was being rounded up by KGB. Soltis writes about this in Treachery in Zurich. It's said by Sosanko that Bronstein said he didn't really write it. But when you read through the book, to me, parts of it sound distinctly like Bronstein. So I think it's fair to say, I mean, you know, this is fairly reliable as far as Sosanko in The Rise and Fall of David Bronstein, it's very clear that they were close. So I'm not questioning the veracity of what was said. I'm just feeling like maybe it's more of a collaboration. Maybe they worked together throughout, because it didn't feel to me like Bronstein just annotated the games and handed it to him. What do you think, Nate?
Yeah, it seems fairly personal, and I also this one I find it harder to get worked up about, because I feel like when you're in a tournament and it's understood that everyone's playing their games, you know, I feel like it's a pretty big deal to like fix matches or throw games. Like that's not cool. But right. As far as you know, like ghostwriting, I don't know. I don't want to like scandalize anyone, but I think, you know, whether in chess or other fields, like famous people generally don't write books, or like, you know, when their names are on books, they might contribute some, but you know, there's usually someone else doing a lot of the work there. And that's, I think within sort of the writing business, that's pretty standard, and it's not really considered, you know, backheeling or anything like that. It's just kind of the way they do the business.
Yeah, well said. And it's not like this was a gripe coming from Weinstein after the fact. This was just that Bronstein subsequently told Sasanko that he gets all this credit for this book, but he felt like Weinstein deserved a lot of the credit. I'm paraphrasing there. But, and yeah, so I think that there's not much more to be said about that. The other thing is, like you say, there's no big historical consequences, and we'll never know. So that finally does bring us to the much teased and hinted at allegations of impropriety. Basically, in the early 2000s, in the Russian magazine 64, Bronstein, and this was subsequently published in some of his books, Bronstein basically alluded to the, you know, there was like a traveling party of like 25 Soviets, a couple KGB officers, along with all the seconds and players that we mentioned earlier. And that they were just getting orders and passing on orders. The main thing seems to be that they did not want Reshevsky to win the tournament. It seems like that was the primary order, and everything else kind of flowed from that, because it seems like maybe if it had been someone, another Soviet player other than Smyslov winning, that would have been fine too. But because Smyslov assumed pole position, sort of the allegations of what occurred became stronger and stronger.
Yeah, so it seems like the basic setup is right. There's a lot of Soviet players in the tournament, the majority of the field actually. And even to my understanding, it would have been even more. They even sort of relaxed the rules to let in a few more non-Soviet players because they were maybe concerned about appearances of impropriety. But yeah, naturally they wanted a Soviet world championship challenger. And then as it shook out, it was sort of a race between Reshevsky and Smyslov at the end, with Bronstein somewhat close behind. And yeah, Bronstein came out with these sort of revelations that maybe the Russian delegation was sort of trying to fix the matches. So I guess that's the allegation.
Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
Oh no. Yeah. So it seems, my sense, having read the books, having read the articles, was like something was going on, but it was still pretty muddy, pretty unclear, because in a lot of ways, Reshevsky collapsed. You know, if Reshevsky had just won his own games, there would have been nothing they really could have done. And of course, you could say, you know, he was in a difficult position because maybe people were playing harder against him. Maybe, you know, he wasn't getting as many easy draws. Although even in this tournament, like there some of the Russian players did agree to draws with him in inferior positions, I would say. So it wasn't all cut and dried to me from the games.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of very specific allegations, Andy Soltis writing again. So the treachery in Zurich, that's the title of a two-part series that Soltis wrote on Chess Cafe. Chess Cafe is now behind a paywall. So if you make like a $25 donation, you can read the two-part series, because Bronstein's, what he actually wrote in 64 is not so easy to find in English. So for me, that was like the best summation. And obviously, Soltis knows of what he speaks. And Sasanko and Smyslov on the couch noted that some players were ordered to draw, as Nate said, to conserve energy. And others were, quote unquote, ordered to beat Reshevsky. So no allegations that anyone was specifically ordered to lose. Obviously, it would be better if none of this stuff was going on. But, you know, ordering someone to beat a world-class player is kind of silly. Good luck with that.
That was part of it that stood out to me. And it's probably characteristic of the era that it was a mix of sinister and ridiculous at the same time. Because, you know, it's like someone orders you to beat Reshevsky with black. And it's like, well, yeah, I'm going to try. But like...
Yeah.
Like, you know, dude, he's one of the best players in the world. Like, it's not that easy to beat him with, like, I can't just decide to do it.
Yeah.
So, you know, it seems like there were some shady characters around trying to influence the outcome. But at times it was kind of Keystone Cops. It was some of the decisions and orders were a little bit ridiculous. But then at the same time, the consequences could be really serious, right? Because, you know, they're connected to the KGB. So the consequences for you or your family could be really serious.
Yeah. And to be clear, so Bronstein did write that he was ordered in round 13 to beat Reshevsky with black. And somehow he did, actually. Now, here's another paragraph just to give listeners a little bit of a feel of what specifically the allegations were. Bronstein wrote how Kiria's trying to erase Smyslov's lead was motivated by psychological circumstances, that's in quotes, when he had the idea of taking his chances on a sharp and unusual kingside attack using two rooks and no pawns. But according to Bronstein's 64 article, there was a behind-the-scenes struggle well before Kiria's sat down to play 1c4. The Troika called Kiria's to the shore of Zurich's lake and tried for 3 hours to convince him to make a draw with white against Smyslov, so that Smyslov could use all his strength against Reshevsky in round 25. Kiria's second Toulouse told me of this that very night, Bronstein wrote. So that's a paragraph from Soltis's Treachery in Zurich, kind of describing what was written. And that's like reasonably damning, I would say. But then, as Andy alluded to in our conversation, Yuri Averbakh didn't consider these allegations credible. Now, I found what Andy said about talking to him personally really interesting, but Averbakh also gave an interview with Taylor Kingston, the translator, chess historian and translator of the Nydorf book, where he said, he didn't think Bronstein was credible. I have known Bronstein so long. Sometimes, for instance, he may speak about his match with Botvinnik, and he says he did not want to win this match or some such thing. He may not be truthful every time. I cannot say, of course, exactly how much, but what he says is not 100% true about anything, really. That is my experience based on many contacts with him. Let us say he cannot be 100% objective. This is the point. Yeah, it's a fascinating rabbit hole, that's for sure.
I found that... Once you get into primary sources with any sort of historical event, it seems like it always raises more questions than answers.
Yeah.
And this is no exception to that. It's just sort of, you know, probably from our vantage now, you can never completely unravel what really happened.
Yeah. And Smyslov took the lead late in the tournament and then like drew his last handful of games, some of which were against Soviet players. Round 28 game in particular, Taimanov had white against Smyslov, and it's just a very sort of bloodless draw. And it didn't really make sense for Taimanov not to push a little bit. And this, when I mentioned earlier that there were vague allusions to some sort of impropriety, but nothing remotely sort of, or nothing overtly accusatory, I should say. So the Nydorf in that game makes like several allusions to sort of how Taimanov just traded all the pieces off. Here's a quote. He says, Taimanov, playing white against Smyslov, traded every piece he could, one after the other, quickly arriving at a draw. The only comment one can make about this game is that Taimanov was in quite a hurry to make a draw. Has he lost all fighting spirit? And then, so he says that in the middle of a game annotation, and then a few moves later he says, Taimanov trades off one more piece a couple moves before the game ends, like short of move 30, and he says, this piece still needs to be traded off, and then it ends in a draw. So, I mean, reading between the lines, it seems like Nydorf, you know, I don't think, especially at that time, no one was going to put allegations in print, but he seems to be kind of rolling his eyes through the page, don't you think, Nate?
Yeah. There's, I mean, once you know this, know about these allegations, then you kind of bring that to the reading of the book and you're looking for clues in every game. And I would say there's generally not a lot, but occasionally moments like this, there you do sort of see like maybe a little bit of a nod to not every game was contested to the fullest.
Yeah. And I guess, again, the more important question is how this, or does this sort of alter the legacy of this tournament? How would you address that, Nate? What do you think?
I guess for me, it doesn't too much, because in line with the Bronstein book, I'm more interested in it as sort of a laboratory of chess ideas, and this occasion where a lot of the great players in the world came together and played all these games in a period of experimentation, and when people were trying and figuring out a lot of new things in chess. And I think the value of that is still there, but for people who are more interested in the tournament as a historical event or a competition, I guess it does cast a little bit of a pall over it.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, that's why we're talking about it, but at the same time, as Andy again alluded to, like, this stuff went on all the time, you know. It just so happens that this is the most such a famous tournament, and the information about it has only come to light in the past 20 years. Like, that's why we talk about it. But there were allegations like this in many other high level tournaments. And again, there's no, I mean, the only allegations were put forward by Bronstein. And there's no allegations of like an outright thrown game. I mean, a game lost on purpose. And some of the games are just so amazing. And I guess you could make the argument that like the last handful of rounds need to be taken with a bit more of a grain of salt. But anyway, I mean, as you say, Nate, the ideas of the games definitely stand the test of time. So I think those are the main points. I mean, I feel like we could wrap up a little bit, and then we have a couple proverbial housekeeping notes. But I mean, in summation, as we've said, amazing tournament, amazing games. It wouldn't be a bad idea, again, once this list of games, which, by the way, I mean, obviously there are greater authorities than Nate and I as well. I mean, Andy Soltis in his foreword mentions probably 10 to 20 of his favorite games. But just, you know, Nate and I did go through the games, and just lots of them just stand out. There's just so many. So you can just look for your favorite games on YouTube. I think chessgames.com already has a list of notable games from it. I actually should give them a shout out that you can, as Christopher Chabri alluded to when we recapped Think Like a Grandmaster, if you donate to chessgames.com, you can also just download the file of all the games. And again, I think it's like 20, 25 bucks. I could be wrong about the amount, but you know, they're worthy of support anyway. So there are ways to look at all the games, and then a decent way might be to look for YouTube recaps of all the games, because you might as well take advantage of modern resources. And there's so many great chess YouTubers explaining games. So something like the Cutoff Queen Sacrifice, or like Max Ove's, was it Rook A7 or Rook A8? I can't remember, but some crazy defensive game. There's just so many amazing games. Petrosian's Rook E6. The list goes on. There's just so many classics from this that listeners can. So do find a way to check out the tournament, especially if you're rated over 1800 or not obsessed with chess improvement. Or wait for Martin's remix.
Yeah, absolutely. I do think at the end of the day, it's a great source of sort of the building blocks and the foundations of the ideas that grandmasters are thinking about when they play now. So if you kind of want to develop that sense of like, what are the key ideas, maneuvers, games that chess is based on, these are great tournaments and books for that.
Yeah. And also, again, special shout out to the King's Indian. If you're like trying to learn the King's Indian, just picking up this book and going through all the games is not a bad way to go. And Bronstein's annotations for that are going to be quite helpful, despite not being maybe as numerous as we would like. So bringing it back to sort of the housekeeping, it's been over 2 months since I've done one of these, so not planning on taking that long again. I apologize. As you guys can gather, this has been an epic project, and we had some technical difficulties on top of that. So coming next month, well, I hope next month, coming next, put it like that, I am Christoph Selecki, the aforementioned Chess Explained, has volunteered to do my system with me. So we're going to tackle another classic.
I'm excited for this one.
Yeah. I should warn you guys. I feel like in theory, I should have gotten some like huge My System fan, because I read it as a kid, and I haven't like read it cover to cover since, but my bias going in is kind of, I would say, more extreme than Wizerk, in that I feel like there's better versions of it. Like, it's great for its time, but there's probably like more readable versions of it these days. So, and I'm afraid to report that Christoph has the same bias, but.
Oh, okay. Interesting. That's what I was wondering, because you can put me on the record as well as a My System hater.
Yeah.
I could never make heads or tails of it. I don't think it makes any sense. So.
Oh man,
really? I'll be interested to hear what you guys say.
Yeah, maybe I'll have to round up another special guest to like make a cameo and stand for My System if we're just gonna crap on it, because it is a classic book, and who am I to freaking criticize Aaron Nimzowitsch? But you know, we're just trying to help you guys decide, is this book worth your time at this time? You know, and yeah, the other thing, Barry Katz, last 2 months ago, talked me out of making a donation to some sort of chess organization, but no such, it won't happen this time. So Nate, what can we do?
I think, so the one I wanted to choose is, well, it's related to someone who's been on the show, but Chess in Slums is the organization. And I know Tunde has been on the show. So,
excellent.
You know, they go into some poor areas in Africa, I believe in Nigeria, and use chess as a means of kind of expanding the horizon of the kids there who don't have a lot of opportunities. So if you follow them on Twitter or Instagram, you can see some really amazing videos and stories. So I thought we could do that.
Excellent. Yeah, I know. I saw that you made a nice donation to them. That's awesome. And I'm happy to make another one. And any listeners who didn't hear Tunde, I mean, just hearing him speak from the heart about like just teaching kids how to think through chess, not trying to necessarily discover the next world champion, but just using chess as like an educational tool. He's an inspiring guy, and it was a great story. So happy to support them further. Okay. Anything else, Nate, before we finally let you move on with your life after this epic project?
No, yeah. Thanks for having me on. It's been great to be on. Nice trip down memory lane going through these books. And yeah, I think for people who want to get a little chess history, they are still really, really great ones to read.
Yeah. And Nate, thank you for all the work you put in. And I'll put in a final plug. Listeners, you definitely need to subscribe to Zwischenzug, his Substack, which basically means a blog or mailing list. Nate writes something new every other week, and it's always insightful. I'm always happy to read it, and check for him on the How to Chess podcast in the coming weeks, and follow him on Twitter and all of that stuff. Any other social media? How's your TikTok career coming, Nate?
I haven't launched that one yet. Maybe that'll be my next project. But yeah, find me on Twitter and like you said, zwischenzug.substack.com. Yeah, writing stuff about chess improvement, a little data and AI in there, but writing something every other week on there.
Excellent. Good stuff. Well, thanks again, Nate. And listeners, we will catch you in a regular Perpetual Chess or at the next book recap.
Thanks, man.
Thanks to everyone who helps make Perpetual Chess possible, most of all to my producer, Matthew Passy. I also would like to thank everyone who helped spread the word about the show. Did you guys know that there's still people who have not heard of the Perpetual Chess podcast? There's even chess players who have not heard of the Perpetual Chess podcast. So we need to fix that. And the ways to do that include writing positive reviews on podcast platforms or YouTube comments, telling friends. All that stuff makes a difference in helping spread the word about the show. But of course, I most of all want to thank people who provide financial support to the show. Without you all, Perpetual Chess would not be possible. So without further ado, I would like to give thanks to the following people and entities. Chessable.com, David Lazarus of LazmanChess.com, coach of Dave's Young Tigers on Lee Chess, Quality Chess Books, the Capital City Chess Club, the Abysmal Depths of Chess blog, Adapta Interactive Web Designs and Services, Apprentice Twitch Channel, Aniti Deer, Austin Clough, Benjamin Porteau, Bill Sigler, Kathy Carr, Chad Oliver, the Charlotte Chess Center, the Chess Central's Chess Blog, Chessmood.com, Chris Flanagan, Chris Lott, Dan O'Hanlon, Daniel Heath, Danny Davidson, David Mitchell, David Shriver, I am Dimitri Schneider, I am Eric Rosen, Eric Tam, Farhan Thawar, Barasawaf, Gary Foreman, Glenn Downing, Greg Harfst, I am Greg Shahadi, Gregory Gulick, James Holyhead, James Kennedy, Jay Garrison, Jeff Martinson, Jeff Schaefer, Jeremy Nielsen, John Jernigan, John Rockefeller, John MacArthur, Kevin Forsyth, Kevin O'Callaghan, King Cell, the King's Crusher YouTube channel, Lucio Casada Silva, the Law Offices of Stuart Katz, Matthew Feeney, Michael Can, FM Michael Oblin, Mr. Mike Shahadi, the famous Mr. Dodgy, the Nerdnaze Twitch channel, Grandmaster Peter Prohaska, Peter Sodi, Philip Flummins, the Playmore Chess Academy of the Hamden Chess Club, Reuven Fisher, Ross Crossland, Seattle Chess Club, Shane Unger, Stefan Kelty, Stephen Martinez, Sven Gearson, Thomas Stanix, Thomas Tachenko, Todd Bryan of StrongChess.com, Todd Kennedy, The Vintage Patsers, which is a Chess.com improver group, Wayne Bean, William Hogarth, and I also would like to thank Ace Vallega, Adam Ralph of ChessEngland.com, Adrian Gutierrez, Al Hastings, Alan and Maggie Sue, Alex Pejas, Alexander Markovitz, Antonio Cancino, Antonio K. Leonfort, FM Andre Terakov, Dr. Andrew Perry, Angus McLeod, Barry Hessian, Bill Juniper, Bill Moran, Bill Trammell, Brad and Andy Rosen, Brett Howard, Lynn, Brian Chase, Brian Mullis, Bruce Scott, Brian Tillis of Palm Beach Chess, Cameron Davis, Chad Hilton, Chess Patser Spain, Dr. Charles Snodgrass, Chris Kiefer, Chris Wayne Scott, Christopher Baumgartner, Christopher Chabri, Christopher Wood, I am Christoph Zalecki, a.k.a. Chess Explained, Coach J's Chess Academy, Costa Carras, Courtney Fry, Craig Mallon, Daniel Ginsberg, Daniel Naylor, Dave Saylor, David Blaskoczek, David Brown, David Hamblin, David Cramley, Dalen Shelton, Tennis Parrish, FM Donnie Ariel, Dwayne Edmonds, Ed Daly, Ed Mead, Edwin Rodriguez, Ethan Smith, Evan Rosenberg, Ewan Richardson, Ian Mason, Felipe Melo Paria, Fox Valley Chess Club of Aurora, Illinois, Francis Letart-Lavoir, Dr. Frank Tortoris, Frank Zananis, Gary Andrews, Gary Lewis, Gautam Narula, Gene Stewart, George Harris, Giovanni Russo, Han Shu, Harish Srinivasan, Howard Behan, Jacob Kovach, Jason Apollo, Jason Murray, Jacques Perry, James Aspinwall, James Benastia, James Muir, Jason Woolham, Jadeep Chakrabarty, Jeff Anderson, Jeffrey Martello, Yep Hoyland, Jerry Wells, Jesse Takumos, Jesse McNulty, Jim Ratliff, Joe Dasano, Joe Valdez, Joel Thomas Ramos, John McAdams, John Tully, Juan Almagar, Dr. John Fallon, John Fernandez, John Fontaine, John Hartman, John Jeffrey, John McMurtry, Jonathan Slater, John Quist, John Tully, Jose Rodriguez, Justin Gardner, WGM Jen Shahadi, Joel Rocky, John Thompson, Grandmaster Josh Friedel, I am Kare Christensen, WGM Katerina Nemsova, Kelly Palmer, Kevin Pryor, I am Kostya Kubutsky, Krishna Gopala Krishnan, Kyle McAvoy, Larry Cook, Larry Ryforth, Laura Boyovsky, Macaulay Peterson, Maria Emelyanovas, aka PhotoChess, Mark Shaves, Mark Fitzpatrick, Mark Miller, Mark Wilkins, Marco Bulatovich, Martin Knudsen, Martin Krug, Matthew Tedesco of SeattleChessMeetup.org, Matthias Plock, the Mechanics Institute Chess Club of San Francisco, Michael Allard, Michael Hudson, Mike Clem, Mitchell Fabian, Nate Goble, Nate Solon, Neil Bruce, Negma Malajanov, Nicholas Isabel, Olaf Mueller-Michaels, J. GM Pascal Charbonneau, Pasi Pasanen, Paul Blain, Bain, Paul Clarkson, Paul Sweeney, Paulo Santana, Peter Lux, Queenside Management Limited of Switzerland, Randall Temple, Ricky Grijalva, Richard Hallenbach, Richard Tucker, Robert Callahan, Robert Tichy, Robert Turner, Rory Coleman, Rory Yearwood, Ryan Berg, the Say Chess YouTube channel and publishing empire, Scott McKinnon, Scott Rose, Sean Krause, Sebastian Finsterwalder, Sergey McCagan, Seth Ruzica, Sean Tracy, Silver Knights in Richmond, Stefan Roller, WGM Tatev Abrahamian, Thomas Brown, Tim Brennan of TacticsTime.com, Tim Seymour, Timothy Ha, FM Timothy Wall, Tobiah Rex, Tom Edsel, Tommy Farron, Tony Rotella, Tyron Price, Vishnu Srikumar, William Brock, William Peterson, FM Zhao Cheng of Chess1000.com, and Zhivko Stoyanov. Thanks to you all for the support, and we will catch you all next week.
Sports Social Podcast Network.